yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, well, you know, the big news of the week, there's really one economic and one political, right? The economic, of course, is the accelerating collapse of the stock markets. All of them. Not just in the U.S., globally. And it doesn't look like it's going to stop soon, according to the latest, still in progress today, developments in U.S. stocks and in Asia and in Europe. No, this thing is going forward. And you know, what's notable about it is the rate of the collapse. I mean, we're seeing drops in the Dow of $1,000. I mean, 1,000 points, were it only $1,000, 1,000 points a day, virtually. That's unprecedented. Not since 2008 in the financial crash have we seen such a thing. And what's also significant is not just the steady continuation of those extreme contractions daily, but the fact that there's no buying the dip movement going on. You know, usually, you know, when you have a big drop like that, in come the investors after a day or two and buy the dip and to make a killing next time around when the stocks rise. Well, buying the dip is not happening. Well, that's a sure sign that this time it's fundamentally different what's going on. You know, this isn't the first time in recent years we've had such a major correction. It's already, what, 12%, maybe 15%? A correction formally is 10%. A bear market is 20%. Well, we're already at 15% after today, heading for a bear market. And we've had corrections in the last couple years here, 18 months, already. You know, there was a significant correction last August when Trump looked like he was escalating the trade war significantly. Stock markets really took a dive. Of course, they turned that around pretty quick by throwing in the towel and agreeing to whatever they could on the China trade deal. But we had another similar contraction last winter. Well, not this past winter, but the 2018-19 past winter, when the trade war really began to escalate. So, a lot of volatility going on in these markets, significant volatility, but this one seems to be different because it seems to be sustained, you see. No buying of the dip, which last time occurred. And, of course, you know, politicians could talk up the solution, but they're not talking up this virus very well, are they? No. You know, in fact, I'll talk about this later, but, you know, there's a lot of funny stuff going on by the U.S. government as to what's going on in the U.S. in terms of the infection rate. All right, we'll get back to that later in the show. Let's talk about the economy first here, right? Okay, so this 12-15% correction amounts to about a, just this week alone, the S&P 500 losses of $3 trillion in nominal values, stock values. Maybe even more now after today. It was $3 trillion here just in 4 days. And also significantly, this contraction is not just tech stocks. Clearly, the tech bubbles burst. But it's what they call defensive stocks, you know, like utilities and banking and some of the others, food, that people have to continue to purchase from companies in that area. So, you know, it's qualitatively, it's broad-based, everything, including tech. You know, this tech bubble was mostly five or six companies. That was it. They call them the FANGs. It's an acronym, FANG, for Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Netflix, Google, or Microsoft, Google, whatever. You know, the FANGs. Well, that bubble is now clearly turning for the first time. It's clearly a technologies correction, and we are approaching a bear market. If we keep falling the way we are, we'll be in a bear market next week. And that has a big psychological effect on investors. They then believe that, oh, this is longer term. It's not something that's going to turn around with buying the dip, and they pull out. So why is it falling so fast? Well, because the financial system has changed. It's been restructured in recent years. I've been writing about this for some time to understand the global financial capitalist system in the 21st century. And in the stock markets, what you see is domination by what's called institutional buyers. You know, hedge funds, asset management companies, these professional investors holding on to huge trillions of dollars of liquidity, and that was cash available to invest. Trillions. That fact that it's institutional buyers predominantly, plus add to that the development of what's called algorithmic equation buying and selling. In other words, software equations that drive what they buy and sell. If it hits a certain level, oh, that automatically initiates buying of a certain amount, ditto selling of a certain amount. It's algo trading, options, hedging. What does that mean? Well, I'm not going to get into that, options trading and hedging and so forth, but it's the way they make sure when there's a downturn they make money, just as they make sure when there's an upturn they make money. Okay, so algorithmic trading and institutional professional buyers, sellers, add to that what's called passive indexing. A lot of small buyers and even companies, corporations, retail buyers, you might say, of stocks have plowed into what's called passive indexes. In other words, a fund that moves based upon the rest of the market, which is driven by the professional institutional guys. They just tag along, you see. It's called passive indexing. They're not really buying or selling. They're in a fund, and the fund might be an all technology fund or an all banking fund or, you know, the top 10 companies fund or whatever. And people have been moving their money into these funds, passive indexing. Indexing means index to, you know, part of the market. As it goes up, you know, the funds go up. Well, a lot of money of retail investors, small investors have gone into that, and they've been riding the rise here in recent years without having to pick and choose. And of course, they ride the tiger when it goes down too, and that's just what's happening. You can ride it up, but you'll ride it down, and it always goes down faster than it goes up, and we're seeing that. Well, what's fueling the professional investors, the institutionals? Well, as I said, it's largely, you know, all this trillions of dollars on the sidelines that they're holding. And it's not just professional investors, you know, big corporations. Part of this change in the financial structure in capitalism in recent years is that non-financial companies have become banks. Yes. We call them shadow banks. And all these professional investors, hedge funds, equity funds, and so forth, asset management companies, these are what's called shadow banks. They're not really commercial banks like Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, whatever, that are more regulated. These guys are totally unregulated. They take money from wealthy people. They don't want you and me buying into their funds or their companies. If you want to invest in a typical hedge fund, you got to put in hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. This isn't Fidelity or Schwab or whatever you want. So these are corporations have become banks. They loan to other corporations. They loan to even the small banks. One third of their profits are what's called financial portfolio profits. They make profits from financial speculation. This has been going on for a couple of decades, at least now. So when the profits of these corporations and these other shadow banks, institutionals, become bloated as a result of multi-trillion dollar tax cuts that we've seen in the last 18 months. Well, they're sitting on all this cash. And what did they do with this cash? What did these corporations do with this cash? Well, they invested themselves, as I said, one third, right? But they also give back to their shareholders massive amounts of cash. They buy back their stock and they pay out dividends. And under Trump, in the last 2 years, in each year, about $1.2 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That doesn't go into expanding real investment in real things to make real goods that you need to hire real people for and pay wages for. No. It goes into speculation in the financial markets. Or they send it offshore to speculate in financial markets, or even to invest in expanding commodities or joint production or setting up operations around the world. The auto companies have really been big on that. That's why they're really being squeezed now, because most of their parts come from all over the world and they're not coming anymore. It's called supply chain problems. Yes, fancy word, supply chains, for having moved their operations offshore for the production of parts and intermediate goods, that they have to ship back to the US to assemble in their auto plants. Yeah, so the Trump tax cuts, and then of course the most recent tax cut was another $427 billion of loopholes that were passed and extended here just this past year. Over $4 trillion in 2018, another $427 billion here, and they're talking about even more Trump. Yeah, he wants to index capital gains, in other words, selling stock. The capital gains tax cut, which was cut to 20%, index that to inflation. So if inflation goes up 2% next year, the 20 will become 22%, you see. Okay, so massive amount of liquidity cash on the sidelines here plows into the market, boosts it, but because it's artificial, it flows out just as fast. In fact, faster. So we've got this $3 trillion this week of just the Fortune 500 companies lost in stock values. About double globally, about 6-7 trillion lost. And this is paper values, though. It's not real money. It's the value of what it could sell for, the stock, in other words. And you shouldn't get too upset about that. Okay, so it's $6 trillion. But in the last decade, the value of global stocks altogether, all the stock markets, has risen in value from $35 trillion to at the end of 2018 to $85 trillion. So a $50 trillion increase from the last recession to 2018. And of course, it went up even more in 19, maybe 90 trillion. You're 50 trillion plus in stock values. You know, this has been a big boom from the last recession and financial crisis for investors. Big, big boom. Unprecedented historical run-up. Not for the rest of us and wages, of course. It's been their recovery, big time. And you know, Obama was just as responsible for this as Trump. They just did it in different ways. Obama did it by giving them free money. Free money. If you were a bank, you could go to the Federal Reserve Central Bank and get money for free, 0.1% cost to borrow. And then if you left it there, the Federal Reserve would pay you 0.25%. So you could borrow and make 0.15%, do nothing. But you know, a lot of opportunities, the banks borrowed it, then they loaned it to professional investors, loaned it to other companies who then invested in stocks and bonds and so forth, mostly. Okay, so, you know, we shouldn't fret too much about $3 trillion, $6 trillion after they made $50, $55 trillion. Oh, but they fret. They think this goes on forever. And, you know, all this talk about corporate earnings. Now looks like first quarter corporate earnings are going to slow down. Well, you know, after you've made 20-25% increase in profits 2 years each in a row, in other words, your profits went up somewhere between 45-50% in just 2 years under Trump. A lot of that due to the subsidy of tax cuts. Well, you know, the fact that it levels off now, oh, it looks like a tragedy. Oh, corporate earnings, you know. It's all relative, right? Okay. Moving on. What about the real economy, the real U.S. and the real global economy? Where is it? And the question today, of course, is how much will this coronavirus really cut into the real economy? Not just the financial economy, but the real economy. And precipitate a real bona fide, actual, according to even the conservative statistics, global recession. Well, Goldman Sachs just came out, the investment bank, and said, yeah, okay, there's going to be a global recession this year. And estimates of the U.S. economy are down to about 1 to 1.2% for first quarter. It's going to be less than that. But that's their first estimate, because it's not as clear the total impact on the U.S. economy, but it's very clear the impact on China and on Europe and on emerging markets, which were already weaker before this virus effect. You know, last week I talked about what are the channels by which we have economic contagion. Not just biologic, but economic contagion from China to the rest of the world. You know, go listen to the podcast for last week, the channels that I identified, and I'll be writing on this as well. Well, obviously, the supply chain, right, the shipment of goods, usually parts and intermediate goods made in China to the rest of the world economies, is a big factor. If China is not producing them, because people aren't working, or they're quarantined, or the factories are shut down, or they're, you know, don't want to come to work because they're going to get infected, then the supply, the chain of supply of goods from China to the other world economies, because China is a manufacturing center, will be disrupted. It's called the trade channel, the goods trade channel of propagation of contagion, economic contagion. Well, obviously, you know, China to the U.S., but there are secondary supply chain channels, and that is from Japan and South Korea to the U.S. Look, Japan and South Korea have moved much of their manufacturing to North China as well as the U.S. Yeah, they moved their factories there. And they're not getting the parts. So if they're not getting the parts and they can't add their, whatever they add value to the parts to ship to the United States, well, then the supply chain is disrupted to the U.S. Indirectly, not just directly. All right, so supply chain. We hear a lot about that, and it's true, but it only affects the goods production, you see, the production of goods in the U.S. And, of course, the auto companies, U.S. auto companies, are really feeling the heat in that regard. And, you know, even services, you know, the airlines not flying back and forth to China or certain places in China, tourism, you know, cruise ships, freight ships, you know, you don't hear that much, but, you know, there are all kinds of ships, freighters, that carry goods and services, goods to and from China that are sitting outside Chinese ports. Won't go in or aren't allowed in, although they're trying to loosen that up a little bit now. So it's not just cruise ships. All right, so what are the other channels I talked about? Well, the currency channel. It's not just supply chain and goods trade channel. This is the currency channel. As the Chinese economy weakens, and forecasts I've seen indicate that there'll be no growth, zero, in this first quarter. It's all over the map. You know, some say, oh, 4%, some say 2%, some say no growth at all. China, of course, will play with its numbers and come up with 5% or something. But currency, you know, the slowing of their economy means that their currency, the yuan, or the renminbi, international trade, as it's called, will depreciate. And it is. They tried to keep it in the range of 7 to the dollar, $1, but it's broken out of that. What Trump couldn't do with his tariff wars, or was stopped from doing with his tariff wars, the bug may do, the value of the currency. Well, when that happens, it pushes up the value of the dollar, because all these currencies trade in reciprocal relationship to the dollar. Dollar's the global currency. So when the yuan goes down, all things equal, the dollar goes up. And if the yuan goes down, then currencies, emerging markets, go down as well, because the dollar goes up. And when their currencies start collapsing, and you can see it particularly in Latin America again, then what happens is money capital begins to flow out of these emerging markets, you know, flow out of Argentina and Brazil and places like that, seeking a safer haven in U.S. treasuries or U.S. investments. But if you're going to take your Argentine pesos and invest in U.S. treasuries, you've got to convert those pesos to dollars, because you can't buy T-bonds with pesos. You got to have dollars. Well, that increases the demand for dollars and further drives up the value of the dollar and further drives down the value of their currency. So we get multiple effects driving down currencies, devaluing currencies outside the U.S. and revaluing further the dollar, which slows down U.S. exports and has an effect on the U.S. economy as well. But it really has an effect on emerging market economies when you have all this capital flight flowing out. Because what happens is their central banks then raise their interest rates in their country to stem the capital outflow. But raising interest rates slows down business investment and you start getting layoffs. And the collapsing currencies in emerging markets also has the double whammy effect of raising import inflation. And because they import a lot more of basic goods than we import, You know, typically, emerging markets are more dependent on imports. It raises their domestic inflation rate, so their citizens get hit with more unemployment and rising prices at the same time. That leads to more political instability. Okay, so what you see here is this currency channel reverberates across the global economy negatively in different ways in different places, but negatively. And then there's what's called the financial asset devaluation channel. Oh, well, we see that with stock markets collapsing first in China and spreading to the U.S., to Europe, and just about everywhere else. And we see it in commodity prices, commodities futures, oil futures, industrial commodity futures collapsing. Oil is down maybe 25% since January. The two benchmarks there in West Texas Intermediate and Brent North Sea, down into the $40 per barrel range now, once again. Industrial commodities, copper, iron ore, down 10-15% just in 2 months. So we see this financial asset contraction going on. And what that does, not just the stock market, but all these other commodities and oils and everything, what that does is create a big dampening effect on business confidence and the willingness to invest. Because if prices are volatile downward, businesses can't know what their products are going to sell 6 months from now. Maybe the thing will keep going further. Maybe it won't. Who knows how much? Well, we better just wait and see. So they freeze up, you see. Real investment freezes up. Real business investment. Because they don't know what the profits might be. And if they don't know, business is, it hates uncertainty. And in the face of uncertainty, it does nothing. And that's what's happening. And then there's finally what I call the corporate defaults channel. Once these companies aren't producing, or financial assets are collapsing, then these companies, whether they're financial or non-financial, start taking big losses on their books. Defaults. And as defaults spread, the awareness of it is that, well, maybe this might be a big thing. I better get my money moved to the sideline. Well, if I'm a equities investor or if I'm a corporation, let's stop all of these investment projects now. Put them on hold, right? Let's start planning about layoffs. Maybe we're going to have to lay off if this thing continues. Yeah, that's the next thing, layoffs that start, with a month or two lag. So we got all these channels where the real economy is impacted by this coronavirus. Well, impacted on what? Well, let's look at the U.S. economy right now. The first revision of fourth quarter GDP came out recently. And what did it say? Oh, well, we're growing at 2.1%, I think it said. But if you look behind the facade of 2.1% GDP, you see that the growth does not really represent a positive condition in the U.S. economy. U.S. GDP calculations are kind of strange. There's some funny stuff goes on there. For example, part of it is the assumption that homeowners pay themselves a rent. Yeah, and then they add that to GDP, called imputed rents. If you hear anything more ridiculous than that, that homeowners, there's 50 million of them, by the way, are paying themselves rent. And I'm not going to go into GDP critic. We could spend a whole show on that. But anyway, what is it in the fourth quarter GDP that boosted GDP to that 2.1 that is really misrepresenting the condition of the U.S. economy. Well, first of all, inventories in the fourth quarter doubled. In other words, this is goods that are produced, not sold, put in inventory. Why did they do that? Why did business do that? That added, by the way, the biggest proportion of the 2.1%. I forget exactly what it was, but almost 1% of the 2.1% inventory buildup. Why would they do that? Well, because in the fourth quarter, it looked like there would be a deal on the trade war with China. And of course, there was. So businesses had already been stocking up on their inventories and expectations of that and continued that stock up of goods. They were building up inventories before because before the deal, they weren't sure whether the new tariffs were going to hit in December or not. They didn't. Trump pulled them. But if they had produced the goods, they could avoid the tariffs. So they were building up inventories in the third quarter, and they continued in the fourth quarter because it looked like the trade deal was over. Now they could really start selling stuff again. And that's how you got that excess inventory to build. Well, you know, what that really represents is all that excess inventory will now have to be sold off. And if they're going to sell out of their inventories, they're not going to produce as much. So production is going to slow down. Durable goods, manufacturing. We're already in 5 months contraction in manufacturing. Global manufacturing recession. So that meant that we're going to have to sell off that inventory, which is going to have a negative effect. You know, it had a positive effect, boosted GDP last year, second half, but now, especially with a big question mark of consumer spending here in this global coronavirus situation, that's not going to play the role. In fact, it's going to play inventories. It's going to play a negative role. And then there's trade. How does that represent a phony boost to fourth quarter GDP? Well, this way. Another strange way we calculate GDP. If you import more than you export, you will get a negative effect on GDP totals. Right? You subtract the imports from your exports. So the bigger your trade deficit, the bigger the negative contribution to GDP. Now, consider this. If your imports change faster than your exports, it looks like you have a positive growth of GDP. In other words, if my imports decline faster than my exports from the U.S. to the rest of the world, that looks like I'm growing GDP. But, you know, it may be that my exports are slowing down and production is slowing down, but my imports are just slowing faster. But the real indicator is the fact that your exports and production is slowing, but it looks like it's growing because imports are slowing faster. So you get a positive boost to GDP. And that's what was happening. And by the way, that trade deficit is probably going to get worse. because the mini deal with China, which Trump said would produce 100 billion purchases of U.S. exports by China in this year, is really going to be somewhere around 30, 40 billion. It's not going to be 100 billion. And virtually, probably most of the purchase, the 27 billion scheduled purchase by China of U.S. oil and gas, natural gas, is not going to happen. China is turning away natural gas ships, saying we're not taking it. Well, they're not taking a delivery of energy products because their factories aren't running. And the U.S. is not going to be exempt from that, regardless of what Trump and his mouthpiece Larry Kudlow say. Okay, so inventory excess buildup and imports over exports are really what boosted GDP in the fourth quarter, that 2.1. You take that away, you know, you're probably close to 1% GDP, slowing down. And that's all before the coronavirus. You know, if you look at last year, real investment contracting 9 months in a row. Manufacturing recession. Commercial property collapsed. Commercial building. You know, on factories and office buildings and, you know, hotels and so forth. Residential housing went up a little bit because of the lowering of interest rates. But there's a limit to that because there's just not the supply of houses out there. So it can't go much more. Government spending, of course, went up because we have an increase in defense spending. And consumer spending held its own last year. But now, if you look at what's happening in January, again, before the virus effect here in the U.S., you know, most of the spending by consumers is by households above the median income level. And that was driven by the nice appreciation in their stock values. You know, when your value goes up, you feel like you're wealthier, so you go out and you spend your income more. And credit driving a lot of that. But if you look at below the median income, annual income households, you get a different picture. You get a picture of coming defaults. Credit card debt. Credit card debt's really about 9%, which is kind of crisis level. You know, if it hits double digits, that's crisis level for those under the median annual income level. Those above, they don't have a problem with credit card debt. And you average them out, and it only looks like there's only 3% defaults on credit cards. Oh, well, that's safe, right? But if you peel it back and you look below the surface of the aggregate number, you see tens of millions of households who are about to default and are defaulting. Not just under credit cards, but under student loans. And reportedly, I saw a figure that 7 million, I don't know if it's true, but 7 million owners of their autos are turning back the keys, are not making payments on them anymore. There is a subprime auto loan problem. So it's a different picture, you see. If you get below the averages, and I've been harping on that, you know, the data, the statistics, you know, looking at averages is very misleading. As you know, I've been talking about that with regard to wages and wage gains. I've been talking about that with regard to employment and unemployment. Averages cover up what's really going on, which is we have a two-track economy in this country now. One doing exceptionally well, and the other doing exceptionally poorly. And it's the latter that's really going to take it in the neck when the recession hits, which I think is around the corner. And by the way, you know, just to diverge a little bit on the politics, that's the group that's, flooding support for Bernie Sanders. That's where his support's coming from, because most of them are young. You see, millennials, Gen Xers, Zers. These are the folks who are really hurting. These are the folks that are up to their elbows in debt and working poor-paying service jobs with no benefits, sometimes two or three of them, you know, living together in apartments because they can't afford housing. have bare bones medical care, Medicaid or medical care insurance, if they happen to be in a state where they could get a state version of the ACA, Obamacare. Yeah. These are the folks that are really hurting. These are the folks who are rallying behind Sanders. Well, we'll talk about that at the final part of the show here. What's going on, you know, with the Democrats who now are just becoming apoplectic about Bernie Sanders? Well, I'm talking about the corporate wing of the Democrats, the leadership wing of the Democrats. Many of the big money bags are already publicly saying they're going to vote for Trump if Sanders is the candidate. It shows you where they really come from. Why are they doing that? Oh, because they got some nice tax cuts, you see, and they don't want Bernie to take those away. Trump gave it to them. Yeah. They may not like the way Trump does things, but they like the tax cuts. Anyway, look, going back to the U.S. economy, looking at where it is now, right? Consumer spending, right? Real spending, after adjusting for inflation, in January, 0.1%. 0.1%. Inflation, only 0.1%. And as inflation slows, it's an indicator that the economy is slowing. So they're both not doing all that well. Right. Talk about earnings recession here for businesses. Yeah, it's relative, but it is true. It's leveling off, right? Well, that'll have a negative effect on business investment. Supply chain problems, that has an effect on earnings. Business confidence in general has an effect on business investment. Ditto for manufacturing with supply chain effects. The goods trade deficit should improve a little bit because imports will fall off faster than exports fall. And we may see some panic buying by consumers as the virus impact begins to grow in the U.S. I understand there's already panic buying going on in Hawaii, that people are stocking up on stuff. Out of concern, it may not be there, or that they don't want to, you know, go to the grocery store in public places once this thing is really widespread. Okay. You know, last week, the Federal Reserve, big headline here in the New York Times, quote, Congress must prepare for the next recession, a Fed official says. They know it's coming. They know it's coming. Yeah, and they know, the Fed knows, that it can't do very much for this. Lowering interest rates by 0.25%, which are already, you know, down near the floor, isn't going to do anything to turn the economy around. It's just going to be more free money flowing into financial markets. That's all. And the Fed, you know, has already been pushed to the wall by Trump. I mean, look at it. The Fed has lowered interest rates three times last year, used up its ammunition even before we are in a recession. So it's going to go into recession with no interest rate ammunition. And we're going to see a big push now, lower it more by Trump here as the economy weakens. And we'll see whether the Fed and Powell chair really respond again. They really don't want to because, you know, they got very little ammunition left for when the recession does hit. The politicians have pushed the Fed into a corner, have negated the Fed. Well, you know, the Fed will throw free money out there again with the quantitative easing. And to save banks next time, watch out, because they'll take your dollar savings in the banks and they'll convert it to collapsed bank stock. It's called a bail-in, you see. Yeah, they are preparing for that. Bail-in. you can't get your money out, your cash out, they won't let you, and they'll give you worth of stock, you see. Well, they can't do that. That's my money. No, it isn't. Legally, when you put your money in bank, it becomes the bank's money, you see, and they don't have to give it back to you. Legally, technically, no. Didn't know that, did you? Well, next big crisis, financial crisis, watch out for the bail-ins. If a bank you got your money in is in trouble. Okay, so let's watch closely the jobs report next week, next Friday. Because once this thing begins impacting the job numbers, then you're going to see consumption, household spending, freeze up. And then the game is over as far as avoiding a recession is concerned because, you know, the other major sections of the economy going on, business investment, manufacturing, commercial property, whatever, collapsing. Yeah, you might have some housing that continues a little bit in some isolated markets, residential housing. If rates continue to fall, you'll see a little bit of boost, and maybe initially, in panic household buying, stocking up on stuff. You know, that will offset some of the consumption decline initially in the second quarter. And what about globally? What about what's going on in the rest of the world? Well, you know, look at Europe. Germany, France, Italy already in recession. Forget Europe. Can they lower interest rates? No, they're negative already. Yeah. Their stock markets are falling at just about the same rate as the U.S. You know, same. So is Japan and so forth. All these stock markets are linked. Same investors investing and playing in all of them. They just move the money around. And, of course, Italy is going to be much worse because that's the epicenter in Europe of the coronavirus. Up in the Italian north, around Milan, which is where most of the, you know, industrial GDP production really exists in Italy. Yeah. But I have heard news that Spain is now quarantining. Well, you know, back in Italy, the Italy case there, this was 2 or 3 days ago, over 50,000 people are quarantined in these little towns. Can't leave them, can't get out, right? Quarantine doesn't work. Come on, you know? I mean, there's no way you can police that to make sure people are staying in their homes. Voluntary quarantining, yeah. They slip out. There's not enough police. It's not as if, you know, you put a fence around this place and no one can climb the fence to get out. They get out. They don't tell the officialdom that they're ill or they have symptoms, right? They don't do that. And they slip out and it spreads. And that's what's happening in Europe. By the way, that's what's happening in the U.S., yeah. Did you know that in California alone, we're supposed to be monitoring 8,400 people who may have been exposed, family members and so forth, may have been exposed to the virus? 8,400 monitoring? Well, what does monitoring mean? Oh, in California, it means you folks go home, don't go outside for 14 days. And if you get sick, call your doctor. You know, and maybe we'll call you once in a while and we'll say, how are you doing? You really think those people are staying home? No, come on. Voluntary quarantining? You know, and the whole idea of quarantine, you know, what did it do? When you quarantine, you just concentrate the virus and make it spread to people who are in the region that's quarantined faster. A good example was the a ship, the something Princess, off of Japan. You know, they wouldn't let that cruise ship with 3,700 people disembark and they just ensured that everyone else was getting infected at such a fast rate that finally they said, oh, we better let them all go and put them on planes, get them out of here. Yeah, like 700 people were infected when they finally let them off. And where did these people go? Well, they got on planes, and I don't know how many, to the U.S. And we put them on U.S. Air Force bases. We put them up on hotels and U.S. Air Force bases, you see, in California here, Northern California, Southern California, different places, mostly California, a little in Texas. Yeah, and we're supposed to have quarantining them. Well, the quarantine couldn't work too well if the fact is now in the same county where this Air Force base, Travis Air Force Base in Northern California, is located, where they are quarantined, now you have people who are getting the virus there, just been reported, who claim to have no contact with the people being quarantined. Well, how the hell did they catch the virus? You know, in some floating cloud that came over from China? Now, contact occurs, you see. Anyway, we have what's called community-based virus spreading, now Northern California. Well, how bad is it? Well, they don't know, you see. Why don't they know? Because they don't have testing equipment. Well, why don't they have testing equipment? Because all the testing up to now had to occur by taking a sample from someone who had a clear symptom and sending it to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, and they did the testing there. The U.S. does not have testing kits. Oh, now they're sending what they have, a couple hundred of them, to California. They sent 200 test kits to California, and we're monitoring 8,400, and we don't know how many else have been infected. The U.S. is totally unprepared for this, totally. You know, they just had a big gathering here in California of the governor and the news media outlets and other, health experts and everything to reveal what's really going on in California. We're just not testing people. And you can't know if they come into the doctor's office with sniffles and a hard time breathing, whether they just got a cold or a flu or they got the coronavirus. There's no way to know by looking at people with symptoms, because most people don't have symptoms who carry the virus and can spread it. But that's what we've been doing, looking at symptoms rather than testing, because we don't have enough test kits. By the way, where are most of these test kits made? Where do they come from? You know, where do these N95 masks that you're supposed to wear, you know, just any kind of mask doesn't do anything. You got to have a certain kind of mask called an N95. Where do these test kits and masks come from? China. Yeah, and ironically, from that province, Hubei, where the whole thing began. Now, you think the Chinese are going to send us millions of test kits? Nope. Not going to happen. Yeah, well, there's a big article here in the New York Times front page talking about this a little bit today, right? The test kits, by the way, that the CDC sent to the states' health departments, many turned out to be flawed. They don't work. What few that they have don't work. And there certainly aren't going to be enough once this thing started. Well, maybe it is already spread, you see. We don't even know because we can't test it, you see. We don't know. Well, we got 8,400 people for 2 weeks now under voluntary quarantine in their homes, and they've not left their homes. And they call in every day. Yeah. You going to believe that? No, this thing is already off and running in the U.S. already. And we already get back to the rest of the world economics. You know, Goldman Sachs says global recession now is going to happen. The main economic engines in Europe, Germany, Italy, France, already contracting. Italy contracting even more. In Asia, what do we got? Well, South Korea, of course, a big epicenter there now. From what I heard, more cases per day than even in China per day. Over 500 per day, South Korea. Samsung, you know, a big Korean company, Samsung, whose output consists of 12% of South Korea GDP, is closing down factories now. Yeah, shuttering factories. Already in recession here, South Korea. Japan, who knows how many per day. Last I heard, there were like 300 cases. Just announced shutting down the schools. Shutting down schools. Taiwan, big blackout. We don't know anything about Taiwan. Why not? Australia in recession. Okay, all of this. Big problem. Let me just conclude by saying a little bit about the Democratic primaries of this past week. And for those who want to read more of my assessment of the Nevada caucus and the South Carolina debates, Democratic debates and primary that's going to happen tomorrow, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. The last two entries there are published articles on that. But the number one thing to take away is that that the Democratic Party money bags, the leadership, is on a stop Sanders at any cost. They would rather lose this election, I'm sure, than allow Sanders to be the candidate. And now the big guns are starting to come out. You know, if Sanders really sweeps, as it looks like he might be, Super Tuesday, you're going to see they're all going to gang up. Bill Clinton's going to come out. You know, Hillary already has. You'll hear Obama come out and make a statement. Pelosi and Schumer will all make a statement. They're all going to try to scuttle sabotage Sanders. You know, they got the 500 special delegates there that they're holding in their back pocket. Yeah, a very Democratic Party. And 1,991 delegates are necessary to nomination, and they're going to split the vote. And when they get to the convention, Bernie will have the most votes, but they will throw the 500 special delegates to whomever they want, which will probably be Bloomberg as Biden fades. And that's how they're going to prevent him from the nomination. And then the question is, will they have shot themselves in the foot in the general election because the millennials and the Bernie supporters will not support the Democrats? Okay, we'll talk about that more next week after the Super Tuesday primaries.